I've called this session Not Ashamed of the Gospel. And from the questions that we had for this session, we had a look at Romans 1:1-17. And this is what Paul, who wrote the letter to the Romans, says in verse 16. I am not ashamed of the gospel. And why would he or others of his day be ashamed of the gospel? This gospel, it's about Jesus Christ. It's about Jesus of Nazareth. And he was the one who was despised by the Jews because he did not fit their pattern of Messiah at all. He was not a triumphant king at that time, and so they saw him as false. At their urging, they had him put to death as a criminal by the Romans. And the Romans had no time for him, or would despise him, because, as we said, they had their many gods. And to think of a man who died on a cross to follow would have been ridiculous. And Paul himself had opposed Jesus zealously until he met him face to face. That, you know, was on the road to Damascus. And then, for this Jesus' sake, he was flogged 5 times with 39 lashes. We get this out of 2 Corinthians 11, verses 23 and onwards. He was beaten 3 times with rods, stoned once and left for dead, shipwrecked 3 times, spent a day and a night in the open sea. He was imprisoned, he says, countless times, in danger in city, in country, wherever he was in danger, sleepless, hungry, thirsty, cold, naked, exhausted. And still, though he's hated by his own people and he's betrayed by false brothers, he says, I am not ashamed of the gospel because, and he tells you why, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. Just as it is written, and that was in Habakkuk 2:4, the righteous will live by faith. And Paul lived then by faith. I don't know if we would face the things that he did, but it's amazing what the Spirit can do in a person absolutely committed to him. And as we said, with God, the only employer, as it were, nobody else to be answerable to. And down through the ages, there are many who have come to know Jesus Christ by faith, and they were not ashamed of the gospel. Right from the early disciples, right down through to the Reformation greats like Martin Luther and Calvin, and so on, to the great preachers of the 18th century, Wesley, to the missionaries who went out all over the world, all of them facing opposition and attack. Now, during the 16th century, the Roman Catholic Church, particularly the Jesuits, sent out many missionaries to China, to India, to Japan, to the East Indies. We know that Francis Xavier went out, but there were many, many more. But they focused strongly on externals. So there was, like, they have to be baptised, observe certain ceremonies. They taught them to be able to recite the Lord's Prayer and the Creed. But after the Reformation, the Protestants preached and they centred on the gospel of grace by faith. And different groups from all over Europe, everywhere, took it out, and often with opposition from the state church, where church and state were joined together, often had a real problem. In the late 1700s, the Church of Scotland, with all its Puritans and so on, the Church of Scotland opposed foreign missions, officially. But missions and mission societies got going, and out they went. And these people were called all kinds, these Protestants, all kinds of different things in different places. Anabaptists, Puritans, Pietists, Moravians, Brethren, Nonconformists, Dissenters, Methodists, Chapel Folk, and into groups like denominations like Baptists and so on. And God worked through them, raising up people like Wesley and Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards in America, and later Moody and Spurgeon and many more, bringing this gospel of grace through faith to so many, so that there was salvation to thousands upon thousands. And missionaries were being sent out by the evangelical Protestants from Denmark and Holland and other parts of Europe and from Britain. So they went to the Tamils and to India, to the Red Indians, to the American colonies. There was outreach there. You might have heard of John Eliot and later David Brainerd. But when Captain Cook's, this is interesting because we're Australians, I think, but when Captain Cook's account of the voyages in the South Pacific were published, it inspired so many to go to the areas where he had been and what he talked about. So the South Pacific Islands were a real place that people went to. It was the most dangerous thing to do. You really put your life at risk. James Chalmers was slain by cannibals in New Guinea, and others just risked their lives. But the vigorous work there and the things that happened spread to India and China and Africa and Madagascar and the West Indies. There was a Robert and Mary Moffat, and they went to the Pacific Islands, and their son-in-law went to Africa. His name was David Livingstone. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about William Carey, because he is one who had such a mighty impact in India and who persevered and went on. So he went to India in 1793, but one of the very great missionaries. His father and his grandfather before that was the parish clerk and master of the free school in their Northamptonshire village. And only children who belonged to the Church of England could attend the school. So chapel people, who were called dissenters, they weren't really approved of, they were really looked down on, and they were not allowed to send their children to the school. William was a child who really liked learning. He really was gifted. But in spite of the brains that he obviously demonstrated early, he was apprenticed to a staunch churchman as a shoemaker and shoe repairer. And there was another lad who was apprenticed with him, a guy called John Waugh, and he came from the chapel people, a dissenter. He had a real conversion experience. And although William Carey wouldn't listen to him, he knew that this guy was really a lot better person than what he was. And William got caught out in a deception, this young fellow, over a shilling. And his conscience was troubled. And so he agreed to go with John Waugh to chapel. And it was different. He heard things there that he didn't normally hear. And the people were somehow different. And something began to stir. And when he turned 18, there was a national day of prayer. And he chose that day to go to chapel again. And you know how God works. Something happened. God's spirit moved him in him in a new way. And so afterwards, later, he was baptized in a freezing river. But there was no doubt in his mind about the fact that he was saved. He married Dorothy, who was a chapel girl, but it was the Bible message that gripped him. So he borrowed books from people wherever he could get hold of them. And so he studied Greek and Latin and Hebrew so he could do the Bible in these languages. And he did this as he was making and mending shoes. He did French, Italian and Dutch as well. Now, his little family, he and Dorothy, were terribly poor, and their first baby died, but Carey was a very good preacher. And so he was asked to be the pastor at a Baptist church that was about 6 miles away, not kilometres, but miles. So he would walk there and back 12 miles every Sunday to preach. But that church grew. You know, it changed. It just came alive. And then Carey read this, The Last Voyage of Captain Cook. Well, that was it. He had such a desire to go out and bring the gospel to these people who are not savages. They are God's children who need to know the gospel. And so a group of local Baptist ministers met to talk about sending someone to India. And Carey was there. He was so keen. He wanted to go. They were doubtful. They wanted another sign from God and all of that sort of thing. But then he preached this message, and these words have made him, people have remembered them. Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. And they were moved by that. And so the foundations of the Baptist Missionary Society were laid that day. Well, in 1793, as I said, Carey and Dorothy and three little sons, and they were under eight, those boys, and a baby on the way, they left for India. And Dorothy was very scared. She didn't really want to go at all, but her sister Catherine came in support. And they got there, and the East India Company was the greatest power in India. The British Empire was sort of on the rise, but they really ran what was happening there. They were in control, and they were powerfully opposed to Christian missions. Why would they be? Well, I guess Christian people and Christianity give others ideas about liberty and justice and caring for others, ideas about truth and right and wrong. And that would never do for a powerful company that was just using people any way they liked. So they refused entry to Carey and his family. So they were forced to settle in an area of Bengal under the authority of the Danish government. The Danes were very good to them. And the challenges were enormous. They had to find somewhere. They land there with nothing, to find somewhere to live, a place to live in, not just a grass hut. They really needed more than that. They didn't know the language, Bengali, and the children and Dorothy became ill. And Carey needed work to support his family because he didn't go with money. And, of course, he turned to God for help. Now, God is our helper. And help came. They were offered the use of a bungalow quite a way away, and also Carey was offered the job as the overseer of an indigo factory. So with Indian oarsmen in a boat, I can't imagine it really, they travelled up river, and it was through jungle and country inhabited by tigers and rhinos and crocodiles and leopards and monkeys and cobras and pythons. And although that might sound very fascinating, when they really are wild animals and you're in their territory, it was very frightening, especially for poor Dorothy. And so Carey arrived, and they got themselves settled there, and he worked in the factory all day as overseer, but he preached three nights a week in the villages as well as on Sundays. And he learned to speak and write and preach in Bengali, and he translated parts of the New Testament and also Genesis, but Matthew and Mark and James. And like the Apostle Paul and others, what you see here, and this is what has rocked me, because we've had a couple of accidents lately, is like, how strong or weak are we in the Lord, when things are difficult? But he was willing to suffer loss for the sake of the gospel, the good news about Jesus Christ. And he had a great grief when his five-year-old son Peter died. And Dorothy became increasingly mentally ill, and later she died, but he had the care of her as well. Then a printing press became available, £46. That was a fortune. But somebody paid that money from the society or what, so that they had this printing press. And so 7 years he was there in India with just his family. 7 years later, other missionaries came to join him, three married couples and one William Ward. And I think, if I remember rightly, William Ward actually married Dorothy's sister Catherine. But Carey had met Ward. You know how these things happen. Had met Ward at one of the services in England before he'd left, and he'd preached But he said to this guy, we want you in India in a few years to print the Bible. And William Ward never forgot those words. You know, somebody says something and you know. And so here he was 7 years later. And right at that time, it was 1800, the Danish governor invited them all to leave the little bungalow and to come to Serampore, where they had a much larger facility, which was so good. They opened a school and all of the printing was able to go on. So in 1801, I beg your pardon, they had the Bengali New Testament, then they did the New Testament in Sanskrit, then Hindi, then Hindustani. By now they were calling Carey Dr. Carey, which they well should do. And people came to Christ. And the fabulous thing was, of course, lives were transformed. And Carey hated some of the Indian practices and eventually got the support of Lord Wellesley, the British governor who was supposedly in charge, to forbid the sacrificing of babies in the Ganges. And how many millions of children were sacrificed to the Hindu gods? Only God knows. But that was brought to an end. And it took very much longer. But in time, as he worked away at that too, the burning alive of widows on the husband's funeral pyre was stamped out, because about 10,000 wives died that way every year. They thought it was their duty. But when Lord Wellesley retired, the East India Company sent edicts saying that missionaries were not allowed to preach to the natives. Now, we're going to identify with some of this, aren't we, of what we're allowed and not allowed to do. Indian converts were not allowed to preach to other Indians, and they were not allowed to distribute pamphlets. And so, and you know, as Islam does today, and things are happening, they forbade conversion to Christ. And this is out of Britain. At least, you know, the East India Company. But like Peter and the apostles, the Christians in India and Carey knew that they had to obey God rather than men. And you know that the evil one never ceases his attacks. So they had every obstacle all the way along to fight against. Fire broke out in the print room and there was stacked paper that had begun smouldering. Now, a bucket brigade was bringing the whole thing under control when Indians outside prized open the windows because they wanted to sticky beak and see what was going on. And the drafts came in and fanned the whole thing, and the whole thing was burnt out. And so many completed manuscripts of the scriptures and were just burnt. And it was, but God, you know, you've allowed that. How do we get overcome this? Carey said, we're going to replace these. So it meant that 50 to 60 workers worked non-stop for 4 months, and of course they had to be paid. And when it was heard in Britain, the people who were supporting the Baptist Missionary Society sent in the money. It was absolutely covered. And those people who support, they're missionaries too. And there are different ways you are missionaries, aren't you? Where you help somebody else for the word to go out. So many lives were changed and eternally saved. And as the family grew, Carey's two remaining sons worked with him. They ended up with two colleges, thriving schools, many mission stations covering a wide area was established. And as Carey was lying, dying in Bengal, he was 73, the last person to talk to him was a young Scottish visitor called Alexander Duff. And he prayed with Carey. And you can imagine the kind of prayer was like, oh God, bless Dr. Carey, help him. He has been so good and all the rest of it. And these were the last words of Carey. Mr. Duff, you have been speaking about Dr. Carey. When I am gone, speak about Dr. Carey's saviour. He was not, William Carey was not ashamed of the gospel. And so I told about him because he was a pioneer, but how many more, and you will know so many yourselves. Adoniram Judson, he was in America, went to Burma, 1807, and in 12 years he's got 18 converts. After 12 years, that's not many, out of the Karen. But after 37 years, you know, he persevered. He was put in prison, all of those things. But there were 100 or more churches and 8,000 believers before he was very ill. He died on a ship in the Bay of Bengal. before he got home to America, but he was with his Lord. And you will know Hudson Taylor of Yorkshire. He went to China in 1853 and established the China Inland Mission. And after years of work had been there, comes the Boxer Rebellion in 1900, and the Dowager Empress of China authorised the killing of all foreigners. I don't know what got into that lady. Yes, I do. The thousands of Chinese Christians were martyred at that time, and from the China Inland Mission, 58 missionaries and their 21 children were all put to death. Now, when Hudson Taylor lay dying, this is what he said: "I cannot read, I cannot think, I cannot even pray, but I can trust." Those are marvellous words. So many missionaries have served with the China Inland Mission. Isabel Kuhn, Audrey Wetherill Johnson of BSF. And look how God used her and blessed quite a few of us. Both of those women were driven out of China along with many others by the communist regime that came to power in around 1950. Eric Little, did you anybody see Chariots of Fire? Mm-hmm. That Olympic runner who died also, missionary in China. David Livingstone, I said, you know, he went with the London Missionary Society to Africa in the 1840s, and he explored that dark interior, penetrated to the head of the River Nile. He lived Christ. He wasn't a great preacher in those ways, but lived it. And he helped end slavery that was going on in Africa. He saw 400 Africans just slaughtered all in one hit. He saw women who couldn't walk any further being driven in their chains along and falling, and then they were just slashed and stabbed and left on the ground to die. And as he told these stories and got them back to England and to other places, it was a great uproar, and he helped to end the slave trading there. Although I think probably in Africa today and other places, slavery is back, isn't it? We know what's happening. Now, those who followed afterwards won many for Christ in Africa. C.T. Studd, Test cricketer, he was one there playing that match that ended up with the Ashes being created, playing for England, a Cambridge man. And he told when he was in Africa, his wife Mary was mostly back in England running the work, controlling things and so on. And he wrote to her, "Don't take a penny from the Mission Society. We stand and will stand on God, and though he slay me, yet will I trust him." John Payton to the Pacific Islands and the New Hebrides. So his first convert was a chieftain cannibal who came to the Lord and who so loved the Lord. He was just a light with his love of the Lord, then he became so powerful as a gospel messenger to his own people. And so we haven't got time, have we, for Amy Carmichael in India and Mary Slessor in Nigeria and all the rest of it. But what I want to say too is, because we've got a lot of women here, for so many of those missionaries, they had wives, and their wives were there going through the same things and working, some back home, but mostly with them, and other missionary women who got no recognition because they were women. They weren't considered somehow to be need any fame or whatever. But it doesn't matter, does it? Because it is God who recognises, and it is he who will hand out the crowns and the honours. And while God was doing so great a work in Europe, what was happening back there was something quite different, because the theologians there had moved to rationalism, and they were influenced by much earlier philosophers like René Descartes and Immanuel Kant. But it was during this time of this great missionary work that Darwin wrote The Origin of the Species. And then we had form criticism come in, where you look at the Bible and the text is all, you know, we know sort of what all that says. And then higher criticism was introduced, a teaching that a scripture's not God-breathed or inspired. It's human and secular ideas brought together over time. So higher criticism is looking behind the text for human explanations of the content. Well, these people believed that, and that was their culture, and that's why that's written. You know, nothing about the inspiration of God himself. So they said Moses was not the author of the Pentateuch. The JEDP theory came in. It's written by four later authors, and the Old Testament began to be completely dismantled. Then the New Testament by German scholars like Strauss and Bohr and Hermann Gunkel. And so liberal theology began to take real root there and affect Christian thought in theological seminaries all around the world. And we know, I mean, a lot of what's happening today has come down. It's called the Enlightenment, but in many ways what was happening regarding the scriptures and so on was what I call an endarkenment, because they denied that it was God who has spoken. And while America and Send and supported missions most generously, this was also the time of the Mormons coming to be, the Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, there were other groups rising up. But into the 20th century, the great missionary work was interrupted by World War I. I can understand why people thought Jesus is coming. Planes, bombs, the world had never known a time like that. This must be it. And you know, we think now it must be right now, and I do think that, but we don't know the time, do we? But nevertheless, World War I goes past, and Gladys Aylward, you might have seen the film about her, London parlour maid, she was rejected by mission societies, including the China Inland Mission, because she was not educated enough. But she saved her pennies and her shillings, and she went alone to China. A 28-year-old woman, 5 foot tall, takes off from London because a woman missionary somewhere in China said she would accept her if she got there. So she went to Hague, got to Hague. She's got a kettle and a little spirit stove tied to the handle of her suitcase. That's one suitcase. In the other, she's got tins of soup and baked beans, etc., and her clothes in the other. It was 1930. And she boarded the train that would take her across Holland, Germany, Poland, Russia and Manchuria. Now, Russia and China were at war. Did that stop her? No. She shared the train with soldiers only, no civilians, certainly no other women. And she was arrested in Russia and put in prison. But this sounds like a little bit, again, like Peter, doesn't it? A Russian girl came and let her out and told her to go for a life. And she did. So that she got down to the docks, and there was a Japanese ship, with the China and Russia being at war, he was sort of quite friendly towards a Britisher, and he allowed her to come on board to be taken to China at no cost. This is God, isn't it? We don't organise those things. And so she got there at Kobe in China. Big long story, but then comes World War II, and she was the woman who later saved over 100 children, leading them across rivers and mountains to a mission station away from the Chinese soldiers and the Japanese bombers. This is what God does, doesn't he, with somebody who's totally given over to him? And that's what we want to be too. And is it relevant for us? Yes, it is. And it doesn't matter whether our work is with one grandchild, or whether we're doing something in the prisons, or whether we're doing something with Rahab, the prostitute work, or in our church, or what we're doing. If we are listening to God, he will use us. And it won't be easy, and it will be tiring, and all of those kind of things. But across the world, in the Middle East and in Africa, other Christians are being killed and persecuted and driven from their homes by Islamists. And even in the so-called Christian West, now that's us, those who follow Jesus Christ, who trust in his word, are increasingly regarded with contempt. So we are no longer permitted to bring Christian teaching or things about Christ and mention his name in schools, in hospitals, in so many places. And so, as Christians, we are derided by the so-called intellectuals as bigoted, ignorant fundamentalists whose views are outdated and certainly unwanted. So, are we ashamed of the gospel? Those who belong to Jesus Christ are under attack in every way, and Satan is certainly at work. God permitted Satan to test Job, but he would not allow him to destroy him. And we are being tested, and I think our two car crashes that Devon and I had, and we were not culpable in either of those, I see, boom, we got smacked. But neither of us hurt. We walk away by the grace of God. And so I know you having testings, all kinds of testings, many of them distressing. Do we give in? Do we become afraid? No, we do not. Our God is for us and he will carry us through. We are on the victory side. We have read the last page of God's word. We know the ending there. And with him, we are the victors. Jesus said in John 16:33, "In this world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." And the world here, well, I think it was Nolan Hunt who said it's like a glitch on a computer screen compared to eternity. What is here is almost nothing. "Count it all joy," wrote James in James 1:2, "whenever you face trials. These will make you strong," he was saying. "You'll be mature and complete. You'll grow." And you know the Lord. When you depend on him, you know him as you never knew him when you're just doing it yourself. But he will not, 1 Corinthians 10:13, "let us be tested or tempted beyond what we are able. There'll always be a way out." Now, Jesus suffered in a way we will never know the depths of, I'm quite sure, that he should be judged for the sin, ours, but of the whole world, is something so unbearable we can't even know. But no matter what comes, this is his promise, Romans 8:28, that he works all things together for good for those who love him, whom he has called. So we are not ashamed of the gospel, are we? And what does God want me to do this week and next week and so on? What does he want you to do? Well, we can trust, we can obey. So, carry again. Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. Amen.